From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a new documentary and photography exhibit explores the stories of Milwaukee men of color and talks openly about mental health. Then, as the Milwaukee Film Festival gets underway, we'll hear from the programmers of Cine Sin Fronteras, or Cinema Without Borders, who have a distinct mission.
We're looking to uplift stories that are really part of who we are, but that far too often don't get heard and aren't told.
And John Phillip, frontman of Mini Meltdowns, talks about what it was like writing songs about a tough year.
I'm like working on the song for like 3 weeks. And I'm thinking about nothing but losing my dad. But at the same time, I guess that's not a bad thing, because you have to face those problems head on and not hide your feelings, I guess.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. Local photographer Corey Fells has unveiled a new documentary and photography series, and this time he's putting men under the spotlight. If his name sounds familiar, it's because we met Fells at the beginning of the year when he introduced us to his 100 Women project that highlighted millennial women of color in Milwaukee. Now 20 Black and Hispanic men from the south and north sides of the city have the chance to tell their stories and discuss mental wellness, something men of color aren't typically given the space to do. Local artists, musicians, public figures, and athletes are among those featured in the series. Fells, along with Mag Rodriguez and Webster X, spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about what inspired them to take on a project like this.
I kind of reflect back on my own personal life. Anxiety and just emotional detachment and just emotional issues were something that I kind of went through. And so as a kid that lost his mom in high school, trying to understand, like, what was life afterwards, went to boot camp immediately afterwards. And that kind of made it a little worse because that made me very sharp and still. Kind of like black and white. I was either sad or I was either glad. There was no in-between. And if it was, it was very disheartening for me to kind of differentiate specifically what emotion I was actually feeling. Until literally maybe in boot camp for a year after my mom passed, I didn't cry. The only picture I had of my mom was an obituary. And throughout boot camp, I always had this obituary to kind of push me through and kind of get me through hard times. And I accidentally washed it. Later that night, that was my first time I cried in a year. So I kind of understood there's something wrong as to why it took me a year to cry about my mom. So I had conversations with professionals, but it didn't really quite work until I kind of sat down and talked with like a comfortable set of friends that were non-biased. And this kind of just let me know, like, hey, Corey, this is how you want to feel, but you can't really articulate it. So I felt like this project was just only suited for that because I wanted to understand if other men felt like that.
So would you say in the process of hearing the stories of men you spoke to for this series, you saw yourself in them?
Oh, yeah, from definitely Mag. Mag is a pretty busy guy, very, very much so. And I kind of see myself in that. But Mag has a tremendous story where he talks about his personal life with his parents and also his girlfriend and just that. And also especially with Webb. Webb is an artist. He's an artist. Everything about him is an artist. And he had this anxiety that he grew up with from high school that just kind of made him a little bit more anxious and just things like that. And I think people will be very, can relate to both of these guys' stories and all 20 other guys' stories too.
And we actually have Mag and Webster X here to talk about their experiences with the series. But I want to also ask you, Corey, as a Black man creating this series and using your own experiences to start this work, what else influenced you to say, I need to create a space for more of these conversations for Black and Hispanic men?
It's taboo for men to have emotions. There's no real middle ground for men, especially men in lower developed environments, to be able to have that dissection of, hey, this is how I feel. I don't have to feel mad or happy. I can feel in the middle some days, or 90% of my year, I can feel in the middle. So I felt like the project really needed that. And then just from media really doesn't really give that wide range of emotions for Black and Hispanic men.
So, Meg, talk about what it was like for you to participate in the series.
I think for me it came natural just because I'm in a place in my life for the first time that I'm, like, vulnerable and I'm okay with being vulnerable. During this time, I think it might have been before or after we filmed this, I had cried for the first time in my life after 10 years. So I hadn't been able to cry since I was a child. Went through a lot of, like, childhood trauma stuff, just like being separated at the border from my mother, not in the same sense of where it is now, but something in that same world. My parents being immigrants and just dealing with a lot of those things kind of, you know, the very black and white where like I have to be a strong, you know, man of color in society. And the only way I get to where I have to get to is by having a straight face. You know, I think as men of color, we're targeted every single day in the workplace, in just regular society where like if you get pulled over and you show emotion, you might strike fear in the police officer. If you show emotion at work, it's, oh, he's an aggressive employee, you know. So I think so much of the black and white has been instilled in us through, you know, just society. And I started speaking up against it a little bit over a year ago when I started going to therapy. And I started preaching about go to therapy, guys. Like, therapy has changed my life. It's changed the lives of the people around me, you know, and it has to get bad before it gets good. So I also understand that portion. And, you know, a big portion of the program that I run here in Milwaukee, Backline, is circled around mental health. And musicians in particular and creatives, it's something that we've all known they struggle with, but no one's ever given them the resources. So yeah, I mean, I think as a whole, like, I'm very comfortable talking about how I feel. On the way in, I was telling, you know, Corey that, like, I'm not having a great day today. And before, like, I had to fake it. Like, I think for the most part, everyone fakes it when they ask, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing great, you know? But I think being able to speak up with, in particular, with other men of color, be like, hey, man, I'm not having a great day today. You know, I'm, you know, my clothes might be clean and, you know, I got a haircut today and I might have shaved and I might look good on the outside, but it's okay to not feel okay sometimes.
Were there any other influences that got you to this point where you're saying I'm okay with being vulnerable?
I mean, therapy was a big role in it, but I think a lot of like meditation. I think as men, we live in our heads so much where it's because we're not, you know, we're not raised to be like touchy. Like, we don't just hug people, you know, we don't hold people's hands, you know, it's considered feminine. And for the most part, all we can do is live in our heads. Anger is all in our heads, you know, and we don't, our bodies, it's a full body thing when we feel emotions, but we as men can only express it in our heads. So I think through meditation, and I've been doing stuff like acupuncture now and Reiki and reading a lot and journaling a lot. I think journaling in particular has been a big part of my life now, where so much of the answers that I've always wanted are from within. So I just had to sit down and write it out. Like, how am I feeling? And knowing that no one is going to read it but me allows me to just kind of talk to myself. So yeah, it's been a big, it's been a lot of things that kind of put me in this situation where I used to think, I mean, the word vulnerable just sounds so scary. It's like you're vulnerable as in like you're prone to injury, when in reality, you know, vulnerability is you're prone to happiness, you're prone to feel, and you're prone to grow, right? You can't grow without being vulnerable. I mean, you think about just, you know, nature as a whole, right? When a butterfly, before it becomes a butterfly, it's in a vulnerable state. It doesn't move and it's in a cocoon and then it all of a sudden, you know, grows. So, and there's many animals and plants around the world that like, they have to be in this vulnerable state to allow themselves to grow. And as men, we don't ever put ourselves in a place of vulnerability and we end up causing more harm by not doing that.
And Webb, how about you? What did you think about being asked to participate?
Yeah, it was an honor because I'm in a similar place, you know, in my life as Mag as well. It's a very transitional period for me, you know. I just got out of a 5-year relationship, which was, like, really a strong one. And, like, I think at that time I was still in a relationship when I did the interview, but I could just feel the shedding of skin start to happen even beyond the relationship. There's so many different factors in my life that have shifted in the last month and a half. And it's been a lot, but I think, you know, in 2014 when I was really writing that album, Daymares, which came out then in 2017, like I was realizing what anxiety really was and what depression really was, because growing up, those two things were not talked about in my household. So when you don't have a name to a feeling, you can't really feel the feeling as much. You don't even know what you're feeling. So you it's almost like I started to have anxiety about having anxiety, or like I was being more depressed because I'm like, I'm depressed, and I'm like a little bit of a hypochondriac. So like I really, I really just take things the extra mile. I'm like, yo, I'm dying. And then slowly but surely you just shed those things, you know, as you get older and you realize like who you really are. So I love being vulnerable now, because to me, yeah, you know, the word vulnerable, like Max, it kind of feels like a negative thing, right? But it's just really not. And it's so much not to the point where that word doesn't even really exist in my head. I'm just being me. Being me is being vulnerable. Like, that's the definition you're going to get when you think of, like, Sam or Webster X or whoever. Like, I'm going to just always be me. And, you know, lately, too, I've been trying to have some, like, shields up, just because sometimes, like, if you're too vulnerable, people can use that and manipulate you. But at the same time, I'm just like, bro, y'all just going to get it how you get it. And, you know, just work with that. So it was an honor, man. And also, I think all the people that Corey chose were just incredible people that I all respect as well. It's a very well curated lineup of men. And it's just key. I think people really need to hear about this project, you know, worldwide, locally, nationally, regionally, whatever it is, because so many people can relate to it. And the way that it's done in, like, I have not seen it really be done in this fashion in, you know, shooting these very, you know, like all the way down to, I don't know if I'm giving away too many details. Okay, cool. Like all the way down to wearing like a black t-shirt and a white t-shirt and him telling us to, you know, bring those different pieces. And there's just something that speaks to it that's really artistic and beautiful that I can relate to. And it's just a well done project. So
what are you guys' thoughts about how this series will be received? Because as you were saying, this isn't a typical conversation on mental health that men of color usually have, and it's also not something that people might be used to seeing. And not that that's a bad thing, but what are your thoughts?
I think it's gonna be celebrated. I mean, like I said, I think people can relate to it, and the way that it's done is so quality, you just can't deny it. To me, it's just a powerhouse of a project.
I think for me, it's more so, I think the project already did what it had to do before people even see it. I think I view this as no different as like an album or, you know, a piece of art, right? Like when someone makes an album, an artist makes any form of art, or a creative creates anything, the creativity, it ends there, right? As far as like the emotion was put into something and that energy now exists, right? So I think I remember doing my interview and the way I felt out of that interview. You know, he asked some questions that like my therapist wasn't even asking me at the time, you know, and I'm walking out of there like I just left through like a form of therapy. And I can only imagine if he asked those questions to 20 men, that means he made an impact in the life of 20 men. To hear another man, like my therapist is a woman, right? And for the most part, a lot of therapists are women, and for the most part, they're not women of color at that. And to hear another man of color talk about his emotions and open up to you about your emotions, these are, for the most part, like not conversations that most men even have with their friends. So I think being able to walk away from that, I remember walking away and like seeing a good friend of mine and I started talking to him about like emotions and the questions that Corey had just asked me, and feeling a little bit more comfortable. So I think the energy was already there in this body of work that he created. And I think, you know, how people receive it, I think it's the smallest component of this whole thing. I think the impact has already been made beyond what, you know, a big publication posting it means, right? At that point, we're talking about views and likes and data that doesn't really mean anything. So I think if an impact that I would like to see is, you know, more men in Milwaukee to like look at this and be like, oh, wow, look at all these men of color doing cool stuff that I look up to and talking about their emotions and being vulnerable. That means I can do that too, right? If we can make an impact in a 12, 13, 10, 8-year-old kid, you know, that can put a name to those emotions, as Webb, you know, mentioned, I think that's where that's the impact I would like to see. And that's what I want people to receive it as.
Does it ever surprise you guys that in 2019, talking about mental health is still considered taboo by some?
it's very taboo because it's a very intimate thing. It's not something that, like Mag said today, when you usually ask a person how their day is, they're usually giving you that cliche wording of like, hey, I'm having a good day, I'm having a great day. When he throws out, no, I'm not having a greatest day, I have so many things going on right now, that throws you for a left curve. So you're not, your response to that is always, okay, well, I hope it gets better, and then you move on. Like, it's hard to kind of attack that. It's hard to kind of respond to something like that because Mag on one end doesn't want to be throw you that left curve, but he wants to be very true and honest to himself. He doesn't want to live a lie. He doesn't want to continue on with something that he knows he's not feeling. And me as a person, I have to learn to be receptive of that and be like, okay, is there anything you want to talk about? Is there anything you want to kind of extend it out? Or do you just want to say that? Sometimes people just want to say that and then move on. Or sometimes other people want to just be able to kind of expound on that. But if they're in the right environment. So I think it is taboo, but it's starting to turn heads.
I think we put words on like taboo on certain things that happen because we're shocked. I don't know. I like nothing really surprises me anymore. I don't think it's I think it's long overdue. But at the same time, like men of color are barely getting a chance to breathe, if that. Right. Like, I don't think we have people of color as a whole haven't been had a chance to breathe and to really. I mean, you look at our communities. The reason why people can't get to where they want to get to is because there's so many, you know, boundaries set in place for us to even get regular needs. So I think if anything, we're early to the conversation of, you know, mental health, because the biggest problem is overall health. I mean, you know, learning that like the ER is that's the doctor's office for the poor and the sick, right? Like, that means that there's hundreds and thousands of people every single day that don't even have access to general health, right? So I think mental health is still very much a luxury in middle-class families, and that whether that's white, black, brown, or anything in between. So I think we're very early on it, and I think mental health, I think attacking, not even attacking mental health, but speaking up on like mental health in particular with men, because men, you know, society still has this like idea of like the head of the household, you know, still being very masculine and this patriarch. And as toxic as that can be, if men can be a little more comfortable talking about emotion, I think that can encourage, you know, our sisters and, you know, our partners to also get help. You know, I'm the first person in my family to go to therapy and stay in therapy. You know, I talk to my grandmother, my grandfather about it, and they're like, oh, is everything okay, son? You know, it's, I mean, it's like there is this stigma of like, you know, I tell my parents, go to therapy, and they're like, no, I go to church if I need some help. So it's like there's still these stigmas. So I think we're very early, and I'm glad it's happening. And I think it's going to be a long journey. I mean, we can't forget civil rights was, you know, not that long ago. You know, there's a ton of like stuff that's just happening in life that needs to be addressed. But I think mental health can fix a lot of that or help with the process.
Yeah, I agree. Nothing is really surprising to me at all, because we've had thousands of years of these social norms that we now have to reverse, which is going to take another couple thousand years. Like, and it's as simple as those like automatic responses of, hey, how are you doing today? You know, if somebody's not good, and if they choose, and if they really want to express it, they just don't, because it's just a norm. There are these things that are just, it's the brain at the end of the day, you know. It's just, it's going to take a lot of time, but I think we'll be in good shape as long as we keep talking about it.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by the Doman Company.
Milwaukee photographer Corey Fells created the new 20 Men series. Mag Rodriguez and Webster X are two of the men featured in the project. They spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell. Fells plans to release the full 20 Men documentary in the spring of 2020. There is more information at WUWM.com. Coming up next, a former white supremacist reflects on a lesson that he never expected to get. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. A series of people and events helped writer and former white supremacist Arno Michaelis change his life little by little for the better. Michaelis recalls his encounter with a worker at a McDonald's who was one of the first to show him compassion, even when she represented everything he was supposed to hate.
Dear nice old black lady at McDonald's, I think of you fondly and often, and I talk about you all the time. You wouldn't think that a cumulative 5 minutes of contact at a fast food restaurant over the course of a few weeks could help change the course of a life and subsequently change the course of countless other lives. But that's exactly what happened. Our paths crossed during a time in my life when I radiated hostility, especially towards anyone with a darker complexion than mine. You demonstrated the courage necessary to respond to my ignorant, fearful aggression with compassion from behind a cash register at McDonald's. I thought I knew all about courage back then. A zeal for violence and the willingness to engage in it at the slightest provocation was my idea of courage. Of course, I thought I knew all about everything. Via an ongoing practice of ignorance fueled by hate and ego, I had managed to convince myself that white people were superior to everyone else and that there was a worldwide Jewish conspiracy to wipe us out. I was terrified of the world around me and confused enough to call that feeling of terror courage. This miserable condition was plainly evident in my appearance. Covered with street fight scars and homemade tattoos indicative of my angst, steel-toed boots and a shaved head completed the look that said, "I hate you," in no uncertain terms. The many people who crossed the street rather than pass me on the sidewalk were wise to do so. But that first time I walked into the McDonald's where you worked, I was met with your smile, as warm and unconditional as the sun. And I shrank in the light of that smile. I was such a pathetic lost soul that a genuine smile made me quite uncomfortable. There I was, very diligently trying to hate black people, and there you were, making doing so seem as stupid as it is, simply by smiling at me. Having drowned the trauma of your smile in cheap beer and hate rock over the course of a week, I was taken aback by your warm greeting upon my return, this time amplified with your recognition of me. When you asked me how I'd been, you might as well have asked me to solve pi to the millionth digit. I was bewildered at the prospect of conversation with someone who wasn't a violent white racist. Once again, I looked down at my boots, mumbled a strained response, and scurried off with my Big Mac as fast as I could. That weekend, I had a swastika tattooed on the middle finger of my right hand, strategically placed so that when someone responded to my aggression with some of their own, I could show it to them before closing the hand into a fist and hitting them. Willfully ignorant of the wrongness steeped into the swastika during the Holocaust, all I thought of was the cheap thrill of offending people. But when I walked into McDonald's for that third payday Big Mac, you took no offense. Instead, you smiled and asked how was my day, and if I was going to have a Big Mac again, and you remembered that I drank Diet Coke. Thoughtless, I had managed to forget my discomfort with your past kindness. I would have chosen another restaurant for my one meal a week that wasn't ramen noodles, which I ate otherwise to conserve drinking money. At 6'3" tall, I towered almost a foot above you, but I felt about 6 inches tall as it dawned on me that I didn't want you to see the swastika. As the ancient symbol hijacked by hate was needled into my finger the Saturday before, I relished the idea of it being the exclamation point on my ongoing flip-off to the world. I sloshed and stumbled around the city, showing my middle finger with swastika to anyone unfortunate enough to encounter me. I tried hard to keep my hand behind my back and awkwardly dug into my front pocket, palm up, to fish a 20 fresh from the check cashing place to pay for my meal. But as the money went from my hand to yours, the swastika was revealed. The look in your eyes for the split second they met mine before I shamefully looked away is still clear as day over 2 decades later. It was the same look my grandma gave me when I used to torment my poor little brother. A look that said, "I love you, but let's stop this foolishness." "What is that on your finger?" you said.
"It's nothing."
I should have said, "I'm nothing," as that's how I felt for coming before you with such disrespect. You're a better person than that. I know that's not who you are. powerless against such compassion, such engagement with the human being I was despite my best efforts. I snatched my food from the counter and my change from your steady hand and fled from your steady smile and authentic presence, never to return to your McDonald's again. It would have been nice if that experience of humanity changed me on the spot, but it didn't. I went back to my dingy house and got drunk out of my mind, blasting white power music with my white power buddies and slurring some nonsense about Jews taking my money from my paycheck and giving it to lazy black people. We set out on the streets to find someone to beat up. People were beaten that night and throughout the next 7 years for no reason other than the color of their skin, their assumed homosexuality, their religion, or just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Yet a seed was planted in my heart that day you saw it behind the swastika. A seed hardy enough to take root and sprout in the desolation of fear and ignorance. That seedling grew, attracting like seeds. Together with my family that refused to give up on me and my daughter who needed me, the kindness of peace warriors like yourself brought love to my life until there was no longer room for hate. Today, I share this ongoing process of learning and growth. Over the past 8 years, I have had face-to-face contact with over 30,000 people and exponentially more via media worldwide. A nonagenarian black man once told me that I gave him hope. An 11-year-old Latino boy told me that he could see how bad I felt for hurting people and that he felt sorry for me. Gay men and Jewish women call me brother. Countless lives were involved leading me to where I am now, and countless people have been inspired to live more compassionately after hearing my story. A story that couldn't be quite the same if you weren't in it. Thank you. With love and gratitude, Arno.
Lake Effect essayist Arno Michaelis is a former white supremacist from Milwaukee. He now leads the organization Serve to Unite. Michaelis is also the author of My Life After Hate. You can find more of his essays and interviews with us at WUWM.com. This essay first aired last year. The Milwaukee Film Festival kicks off today, and we'll hear about the challenge of programming Latinx films that showcase all of that diverse community. That's coming up next on Lake Effect here on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The 11th annual Milwaukee Film Festival kicks off today. For 15 days, festival attendees will be able to choose from over 300 movies in a number of categories. There'll be Hollywood classics, shorts, documentaries, and world cinema, just to name a few. Well, part of the festival's mission is to offer festival-goers a diverse array of work from voices not always represented in mainstream movie making. Black Lens showcases African-American lives, for example, and Genre Queer explores LGBTQ+ experiences. The Latinx communities also have a showcase. Claudia Guzman and Yanette Martin program Cine Sin Fronteras, or Cinema Without Borders. It's a tall order to express the full experience of such diverse groups of people in only 12 films. WUWM reporter Angelina Mosier-Salazar sat down with them to find out how they decide which films to include, and Claudia begins by describing how Cine Sin Fronteras came to be.
The Milwaukee Film Festival came to us 4 years ago looking for curators for a film program that would highlight the Latino and Latin American experience through film. And what we really began with was a philosophy of inclusion, where we really wanted to represent the diversity within the Latinx community and make sure that we were inclusive of, for example, the Afro-Latino experience, the queer experience, immigrant experience, undocumented experience, and really sort of complicate the idea of what folks think the Latino community is.
You are more than aware that your audience is not just Latinos. that it is also people outside the Latino community. So not only do you have a responsibility of representing us to ourselves, but also us mm-hmm. to other people. Mm-hmm. Janet, mm-hmm. Did you feel like an immense amount of responsibility?
Yes. I think what Claudia has mentioned regarding, like, how do we present to our people and also not our people, right? Like, our folks that are not coming from la experiencia de, you know, Latinoamericana and what that means, right? That's a big, big test, right? Because we know what media can do when it misrepresents us, and that's the opposite of what we're trying to make sure that we're providing to people, right? Is like an empowering representation, a different representation, like a way for people to rethink of what they thought of maybe another community to be.
What's something else that's on your guys' criteria for what movies make it in?
Combination of things. One is we're looking for films that are doing well at other film festivals that are, that are landing well with other audiences across the country or around the world. But that's not all. We're also looking for those hidden gems that we feel tells an important story that is far too often untold. So for example, you know, last year we showed, or I don't know, maybe it was 2 years ago, but we showed the documentary Dolores about Dolores Huerta. And it is shocking to me how many people don't know the story of Dolores Huerta. And she worked right alongside Cesar Chavez, but everybody knows his name. There's a stamp with his picture on it and all of that, but far too many people don't know the story of Dolores. And it was an honor to premiere that film as part of the Milwaukee Film Festival that year. We also showed the film Chavela, a documentary about Chavela Vargas, who also was a groundbreaking mariachi, or what's she? Ranchera singer, who really defied gender norms and stereotypes in Mexico. And a lot of people don't know her name either. And so we're looking to uplift stories that are really part of who we are, but that far too often don't get heard and aren't told.
Latin America is so diverse. Like within Latin America, you have Brazil, you have El Salvador, you have Mexico. And even within those countries, the people look so radically different. So when you're saying we try to highlight a voice, you know, that maybe isn't known as well or isn't as famous, do you guys also look at country of origin?
Over the years, we've tried to be really conscious of the number of countries we're representing. I don't have the number off, in front of me, but I think we've represented about 13 different countries. And at the same time, we're trying to be responsive to our demographic in Milwaukee. So it's not uncommon to see two films from Mexico in a year because we know that much of the Latino population here is from Mexico. This year, we happen to have two films from Cuba, and that is just because we found two excellent films from Cuba. So every year, it's a balancing act of what are the best films that are really moving our hearts and minds? What are the films that are representing a broad diversity of not only countries, but communities and identities? What do we think, what stories do we think need to be heard that maybe haven't gotten a platform yet?
The Latino experience is more than just whether or not you're documented. So I want to know, like, do you guys feel that perceived pressure of, like, well, you better have an immigration story or you better have an undocumented story?
I mean, I will say that we do feel a sense of responsibility that, you know, the film festival is not just a space of entertainment. It is a space of bringing people together to learn something, to experience and feel something, and then hopefully to be moved to think differently or to connect more with others. This year we have two films that look at the U.S.-Mexico border because we know that this is an issue that the media is treating in a way that we perhaps disagree with, and we'd like to present a different story. And we have that opportunity with the film festival that attracts thousands of people to possibly come and watch this film and engage in dialogue with people and see things differently than they might have otherwise.
current events. That's important for you guys?
Yes. Yeah, we're always balancing, like, are we responsive? Do we want to say something or take a stance in a way to what we're currently seeing? And also, we're also taking a stance to stuff in our past, you know, or histories from the diaspora that many of us wouldn't know otherwise.
You know, I got to ask you this. Is there one film that you guys are just, like, so excited for? So, like, oh, I'm so happy. I'm so proud of us that we got it in this year.
I would say for me, it is Bako Soul, because I remember seeing the Kickstarter when they needed help to go into post-production. And so that had been a film that I was following for a little bit. Actually, like, the whole time, like, oh my gosh, I really hope they make it with their fundraiser. Like, I really hope that they do. And then by the time that we could request for a screener, like, I put it in, and yeah, like, it had been finished, and now it has been touring at other film festivals. So I'm happy that we got it, and more than anything, I'm so glad that that film gets to be shown and, you know, influence, like, many folks around, like, what it means to create a whole music genre, you know, in an island like Cuba. Yeah.
And for you, Claudia?
My favorite film this year is Yuli. It's the story of Carlos Acosta, who is a ballerina from Cuba, who was the first Black ballerina to be cast as Romeo for the Royal Ballet. And it's his story. It includes, you know, fictitious reenactments of his childhood with this amazing child actor. But then it also incorporates archival footage of Carlos dancing, as well as contemporary footage of Carlos now choreographing for Danza Acosta, his own dance company that's in Cuba. So it really tracks his story from his childhood, growing up with a really strict father who really forced him to do ballet. He didn't want to do it, but he was so talented that his dad said, you know, this is an opportunity for you to have a better life than I had. And throughout those childhood flashbacks, his father is a really strong figure, making sure that Carlos understands the importance of his Black identity, of his male identity as a dancer, and of his Cuban identity, even as he becomes a world-renowned star. And so it's just a really beautiful, moving film that is really uniquely designed with that mix of fiction and archival. And it's just adorable, and I think a really important story that will kind of shake up people's notions of masculinity as well as, you know, at Blackness.
Excellent. Thank you so much, ladies, for your time and for helping me pull back the curtain a little bit as to what goes into developing the program for Cine Sin Fronteras. Thank you.
Claudia Guzman and Yanet Martin program Cine Sin Fronteras, or Cinema Without Borders, for the Milwaukee Film Festival. There's a link to the complete festival schedule, which gets underway today, at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then chat with Wisconsin native John Phillip about his band Mini Meltdowns and their new EP called Destined for Disaster. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin native John Phillip is no stranger to Milwaukee. He spent two decades here as a working musician, performing with a variety of groups in the area. He co-founded a record label here called The Good Land, which continues to be based in Milwaukee, despite the fact that Phillip himself now lives in Nashville. It should come as no surprise, then, that Phillip and his band Mini Meltdowns have come back to Milwaukee to celebrate the release of their first EP called Destined for Disaster. The group will have their first full band show this Friday at X-Ray in Cudahy. Phillip joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the new EP, which includes this song, I Wanna Die.
John, Philip, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Joy.
So, you know, you've recorded with a number of bands, including Trapper Shep's group here in Milwaukee.
Indeed.
But what is it like moving into the position of being the frontman?
It's actually extremely terrifying for me. You know, when I first put this project together, I had no idea I would be playing a show. I had no idea I would be fronting a band of musicians. I had no idea I would be on my second release. I basically just started recording songs because when I was living in Nashville and nobody was making music with me at the time, I was just like, I want to make rock and roll music. And nobody else is doing that in my circle of friends, that the kind that I wanted to make. So I just started recording my own songs, and then I made a first release, and I was like, okay, didn't play a show on it. And then now I have this release, this new one that just came out, and now I actually have to play a show and play guitar and sing at the same time. And it's pretty terrifying to me, to be honest.
What is that experience like versus playing in a band as, in some cases, kind of the replacement drummer, it seemed like? In some cases, you know.
A lot of cases, yeah.
A lot of cases.
And that's funny you say that. It's kind of oozing with irony because I actually played with Tommy Stinson from The Replacements for a while, too. So I was a replacement. but it was really fun playing drums because you have something to hide behind. And if you've been doing it for a certain amount of time, it just becomes second nature to you. You know, rhythm, the way you have your kit set up, and then you're kind of in back too. I liked that. But now it's really scary to be in front and just kind of like be naked in front of everybody with my voice and what I'm doing with my hands, and I have nothing to hide behind.
And we were talking about this a bit before the interview, but this EP is in many ways very personal for you.
Extremely. Yeah, I didn't really set out to start writing songs about a particular person or subject. Just like when I would sit down with my guitar and I would start making chord patterns and writing melodies that I liked. And then all of a sudden I would just write what was fresh on my mind. And what that started being about was losing my dad last year, about the anxiety and depression along with that. And then I got sick last year as well and needed surgery. I had a couple of toxic relationships in my life at the time that were really bringing me down. And I'm sure as a result of that, my anxiety and depression with whoever I was with at the time wasn't good for them either. You know, it's a chain reaction for that.
How did you work out those feelings inside of these songs?
I basically would just, I would take long walks with my pug, Baxter, and I would open my notes on my phone and I would just start writing lines that would come to me. I guess it was a bit cathartic, but I never like really was like, okay, I'm going to go walk my dog and I'm going to go write about something I'm feeling right now. It would just be like, I would be listening to music, walking my dog, it'd be nighttime, and then all of a sudden I would be like, I would have this idea. And then I would try putting it to the chords that I wrote. And it ended up, in the end, started to be pretty cathartic for myself. And it started making me feel better. But also, at the same time, I'm like rehashing and thinking about my dad when I'm writing a song about him. So I'm like working on the song for like 3 weeks. And I'm thinking about nothing but losing my dad. But at the same time, I guess that's not a bad thing. Because you have to face those problems head on and not hide your feelings, I guess.
Yeah. Can I ask you what happened with your father?
Yeah. He was always a very healthy guy, but he got diagnosed with bile duct cancer at 62. And they caught it at stage 4. So it's not a good time to catch it. And I guess it's a rare form of what he had. I guess bile duct cancer in general is rare. But then he also had Barrett's esophagus along with that, which is something that is also, you know, with your digestive, you know, like your GERD and heartburn and stuff, it's all related to that. But then when they checked him out, he basically had a couple tumors in his liver, he had cancer in his blood. So basically the doctor was like, okay, you have 6 months to live if the chemo doesn't work. If the chemo does work, you have a year. So he just got sick and had to go to the hospital, and then he got that that reading from the doctor and had to deal with that. He lived 13 months, so he lived a little bit longer than that.
What was that diagnosis like for you?
It's weird. He told me not to worry at all. Even when he got his chemo port and he started doing heavy bouts of chemo, he was still pretty active. He was going to work at that point still. And he actually took a trip down to Nashville with my stepbrother, Eric, to the eclipse that happened. Yeah, he actually came down to Nashville even, and we, like, went sightseeing. But then the chemo got to him and also did the cancer. So right around Christmas time that year is when he started getting really bad. And once I saw him deteriorate, that's when things got really bad for me, just seeing him deteriorate like that. You know, he was such a larger-than-life guy. You know, we were talking about your father and how you lost him and how he was like a larger-than-life guy. So it's hard to see somebody that's just like your hero and that's just so strong and so busy and loving life and then just have something like that happen to you and watch somebody deteriorate that you love. You know, it was horrible.
Yeah. It really, you know, losing someone who is so close to you, especially a parent, it really does make you reanalyze what you're doing and what your life looks like. You know, the EP is called Destined for Disaster.
Yeah, it's a little dark sounding.
Is that how you felt?
Yeah, and that's actually how I feel. You know, I'm a pretty positive person, but after that happened to my dad and seeing that all go down in front of my eyes, you know, and it was how horrible it was, I just realized that nothing good lasts forever. And all of our time is limited here. You know, anything can happen at any point in time. So really and truly, I named it that because no matter what good you have going on, this is pretty dark, I'm sorry. And I'm not that sad or depressed, but like no matter what good happens, it's not going to last forever. You should enjoy it while it lasts.
It's funny that you say, you know, this sounds so depressing because the music actually doesn't. The songs
Very
don't
true.
Actually sound depressing.
I guess I tried to do it more in like an uplifting kind of way. Like I'm battling this thing, but I don't want it to sound depressing. I want to try to get through this.
So to shift gears just a bit, this is actually going to be your first time on stage with all of your bandmates.
It is, yeah.
Are you excited?
I'm so excited, I can't contain myself. Like the last week, I've been having trouble sleeping. The show's not till Friday, so like, you know, a week and a half even before the show, I started like not being able to fall asleep, and it's almost like nervousness, but it's also excitement, but it's also like, I hope I don't suck.
What is it like to be back in Milwaukee? Because you've been out in Nashville for a bit now, but you're originally from Kenosha.
I am, yeah. Wow, nice one. Yeah, I love being back here. My mom still lives here, so every time I come back, I get to stay with my mom. And I try to come back every couple months. And as much as I love Nashville and the area south of Nashville that I live in called Franklin, I mean, it's beautiful, and the weather is always amazing. Summer's a little too hot for me. But I love coming back here. I miss Cops. I miss Thai Kitchen. I miss my mom. I miss my friends. I miss my music scene. I miss Lake Michigan. You know, when I flew over it last night, I was just like, oh, my God, it's just so beautiful. And, you know, I lived next to Lake Michigan for 36 years, so it was hard to leave. So every time I come back, I'm like, God, I wouldn't mind moving back at some point. I just love it here.
You have a record label. This EP actually came out on your record label, and it seems like that's still based here.
It is, yeah, very much. No matter how much I tried to put roots musically in Nashville, I can never get any footing like I did here. So I just decided not to move my label at all. I mean, I haven't released a band from Nashville yet, and My label partner, Christopher Johnson, who's a lawyer in town, he's kind of like a little bit of a socialite. So it's nice to have him be the face of the label here when I'm gone. You know, he goes to see a lot of bands. He's very social. And the whole branding is based around Wisconsin, even the record label design, like the logo.
Well, in the good land, is that a term that references Wisconsin?
It is. Yeah, I took it from the Alice Cooper part of Wayne's World.
Nice. So while you are in Nashville, there are still a lot of things that keep you rooted in Milwaukee. And one of the things that you mentioned is, you know, the music scene here. Where do you feel like you fit into that scene?
That's a great question. I feel as if since I was in this music scene for over 20 years, it's just always a part of me now. I just feel as if it's ingrained in my DNA. Like when I'm doing my album release show here this weekend, I'm not even playing an album release in Nashville. I'm just playing one here just because this is where all my friends are. You know, my friend Graham Hunt is playing the show as well. He played in Trapper's band with me for a while, then went on to be in like the Midnight Reruns and all these other bands. But then also Telethon's playing, and Goodland actually released Telethon's first album. So it's like everybody that I'm kind of like involved with, friend-wise or business-wise, I can't escape it. It's part of me.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, we're happy to have you back in Milwaukee.
Thank you
so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks a lot for having me, Joy. Appreciate it.
Gonna Miss You by the Mini Meltdowns. It's one of the songs featured on their first EP, which is called Destined for Disaster. Lake Effect's Joy Powers spoke with the group's frontman, John Phillip. The band will have their EP release show this Friday at X-Ray in Cudahy. And that wraps up another week's worth of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing the show every week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Taryn Powell and Angelina Mosier-Salazar this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. And Michelle Maternowski, our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock now, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.